Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds.
And I'm Annie Harview. Tonight on Right On Radio, Ian Graham Leask talks with John Medeiros, author of Self-Divided. In 1995, John Medeiros and his identical twin brother participated in a gene therapy study in which the HIV-positive twin was infused with billions of genes from the HIV-negative twin. This memoir details, from a first-hand perspective, a time in our recent history when the world had to reckon with the emergence of a seemingly undefeatable virus.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the second part of our show, Liz Olds will be talking with Bill Schnee, author of Chairman at the Board, Recording the Soundtrack of a Generation. Chairman of the Board is an intimate, funny, and absorbing look at the music business by an insider. Schnee has engineered for such artists as Barbra Streisand, The Jacksons, Marvin Gaye, The Pointer Sisters, Boz Scaggs, and many others. He received a Grammy for his engineering of Whitney Houston's mega hit, I Will Always Love You. He currently lives in Franklin, Tennessee with his wife, Sally. All this and more. So stay tuned to Right On Radio. Ian, are you there?
I am here.
All right, you are on the air.
And I am here as well.
Ah, good. Okay, John, off you go with that piece of reading that you're going to do.
Sure, thank you. As with most identical twins, the first person singular does not exist because our stories are inseparable. The closest to my is our. Our story begins with us living in an overcrowded. I'm sorry, did you say that again?
Something came. Keep reading, John.
I'm sorry. Our story begins with us living in an overcrowded apartment. Mom.
Hold on, John. You guys need to turn off your mics so that John can read. Go ahead.
Should I start over?
Yes, just start over there.
Thank you. As with most identical twins, the first person singular does not exist because our stories are inseparable. The closest to my is our. Our story begins with us living in an overcrowded apartment. Mom and Dad, our two oldest sisters, my brother Bobby and I, six total. At an early age, I became aware of the symmetry in our family, though I did not know that symmetry was the word for it at the time. Dad and two boys, Mom and two girls. There's a sense of balance when looking at us from this perspective. Then there's the realization I have of the number two. Bobby and I, we were two. He was born 2 minutes before I was. 2 years before that, our sister Debbie was born. 2 years before that, our sister Donna was born. 2 minutes, 2 years, 2 years, two girls, two boys, two twins. I grew to like math. It began there on a clear summer morning in mid-May in utero. As with all twins, it's ironic to say that we were born at the same time, when for 9 months before our birth, we occupied the same space. The womb and egg divided. One fertilized egg finding the need to split itself in half, perhaps to rebel against itself, perhaps to stand alone from any other. Perhaps it was his wish, so my brother tore the egg in half, the way a knife tears at flesh. After all, he always was more aggressive. Or perhaps it was my wish because I feared what life would be like facing it alone without him, knowing even then that I needed him. Regardless, there we were, identical twins in the making, split in half from the very beginning of our conception. Even in the womb, our bodies took shape and grew in silent competition. My hand pushing on his belly, his foot kicking my arm. We were crowded in that mutual space with me closer to our mother's heartbeat, him closer to the birth canal. Even then, there was no escaping each other. We became as real to each other as the fluid that nurtured us. Today, I think of what it was like for us in that shared space, squeezed together in that dark universe, feeling that once we were born, we would be rid of the other forever. We don't remember the story, but we remember what we were told. And perhaps it was nothing like this at all, but because we remember it this way, it remains that way forever. This much is fact. The pictures were taken when we were infants, and like us, they are identical. Closed eyes, knit hats on our heads, and each of our tiny bodies wrapped in blankets with elephants playing drums and trumpets, as if elephants had such talents. But the one feature different in each of the photographs can be seen on our left feet. One of us, we don't know which, has a toe with fingernail polish on it. Such a minor detail, undetectable to most, but this detail would somehow define us for years to come and haunt us for the rest of our lives. It was just fingernail polish, associated with little girls whose parents wanted them to grow up too fast. Fingernail polish, a convenience for others to tell us apart. We don't know what color it was because the photograph is black and white, but it was certainly closer to black than white, a lighter shade of black, most likely red. For years, we would argue over this photograph as if admission to wearing the polish were akin to confessing far greater taboos. And our parents will always keep the secret of who was forced to wear the polish, although it no longer matters. All that matters now is that it once mattered. And while we shall never know whose toenail was painted, we will remember this. The tenement where we grew up was in the middle of a block of the street of Peace Street, a street which held a certain power in its name, a name that was both appropriate, like a Catholic, with a Catholic hospital standing on the corner, and ironic, because the neighborhood, like our house, was anything but peaceful. In our not so tranquil home with sirens passing by regularly, we had the largest room in the house, and everyone, even the guests who rarely visited, had to walk through it to get to any other room. With our parents in one bedroom and the girls in the other, this large transformed dining room became ours. As infants together in the same crib, we were oblivious to the boundaries between us. It was impossible to tell where one of us ended and where the other began, and we welcomed the fusion and confusion gracefully, peacefully sucking each other's thumb. Back then, we made sounds to imitate in our private world the loud universe around us. Some say it's a private code, while scientists call it cryptophagia, a secret language used only by twins to communicate with each other. One night in December 1965, when we were all of 6 months old, we knew exactly what to do when our parents tried to quiet us by separating our cribs and putting them on opposite sides of the room. Lights out, mild clatter. Little did they know that early the next morning, after a night of restless sleep, they would find both cribs together in the center of the room as though we had never been separated at all.
Wonderful. And a very good reading. You've been listening to Self Divided, a memoir by John Medeiros. It's the winner of the Howling Bird Press Nonfiction Prize. John is a poet, a memoirist, identical twin, as you've just seen, and a lawyer. He's the author of Couplets for a Shrinking World and co-editor of Queer Voices, Poetry, Prose, and Pride. His work has appeared in numerous anthologies and literary journals, and he's the recipient of two Minnesota State Arts Board grants, Gulf Coast's Nonfiction Award and the AWP Intro Journals Award. His works have been nominated for a Minnesota Book Award and recognized as a notable essay in Best American Essays. He has an MFA and a JD from Hamline University, and he lives in Minneapolis with his husband and their menagerie of pets. Fantastic. Great to have you back on the show, John.
Good to be here, Ian. Thank you.
Yes, and what a wonderful book. My goodness. I don't even know where to start in asking questions about this, because it's just so rich for somebody to come in and try and interview you about this work. Twins, gayness, horoscopes, numbers, HIV, COVID, balance, disbalance, Wow, I don't even... there's so much here. What a rich read this is. I highly recommend this book. Where do we start? I think possibly you should just try and get our listeners to understand what the book is generally about.
Yeah, sure. I can certainly do that. This book actually, believe it or not, started out as a poem. And my poems tend to be rather narrative. And when I was in my MFA program at Hamline, I took the poem and I added more narrative and more narrative and more narrative and realized that what I was really trying to do was create a nonfiction story that was very lyrical and also one that was able to show the reader how I perceive my narratives. And so there's poetry in this book, there's lyricism in this book. I also use white space in this book the way that poets use white space as part of the narrative. And so there's all that in there. But basically, what the narrative itself is about is I obviously am an identical twin. And I have learned throughout the years that there are stories that I have that I cannot separate from my brother. And then there are stories that I have that make me independent from my brother. And a large part of my life was that journey to find independence and find my own voice. And I knew that what I wanted to do with this book was raise the question of how we claim identity when we're always a part of someone else's identity. That's really the crux of this book. Mm-hmm. And I raised that question by using my own personal narrative. So I raised that question from the perspective of an identical twin. So there are moments in the book where my narrative is my brother's narrative. And in those moments in this book, the page reads like any other book that you would read, the full page with just a normal margin. And then there are times in my story where I am really trying to separate myself from my brother and be my own voice and be my own person and be seen as my own person when others around us really just see twins as an extension of each other. And so when the narrative becomes my own narrative, which is separate from my brother, on the page, there's an indent on the right. It initially was a half a column, but we made it a little bit more than half, just so the reader would know, could pick up the book at any time and know exactly where the voice was coming from. And I knew that there were stories that were mine, and I embraced those. And so there are moments in the book that I experienced things that helped define me as a person that is a person unique from my brother. And those moments include my homosexuality and coming to terms with that, and an HIV diagnosis when I was 25 years old and coming to terms with that. Those were two significant moments in my life where I felt I could embrace those and I could approach those as a singleton, as opposed to an identical twin. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I come to terms with that. I come to terms with my homosexuality. I come to terms with my HIV diagnosis. In fact, I refer to my HIV as a lover who will be with me for the rest of my life. And that's exactly how it feels many times.
Yeah, I bet it does.
And then what happens is it's only when I get to the point of being this self-actualized individual person do I find myself in an experimental treatment at the National Institutes of Health where I'm being infused with 10 billion of my identical twins' cells in a gene therapy study as a treatment for HIV. And that's how the book ends.
Yeah.
So there's that hospital thread throughout it as well.
Yeah. Tell us ahead of the game, because we're going to be nervous about this, unless you do. Where is your HIV right now? And did the therapy with your brother help it?
Oh, thank you. My HIV right now is completely managed. HIV has become a much more manageable disease over the years. The study that I was in was took place when I was it started when I was 28 years old. So it was the book is really set. The hospital scenes is set in the mid 90s, where when it was still, you know, a death sentence for many people. One of the reasons why I entered the study was because the medications that I were taking, my body sort of became resistant to them. And there was a time when many of us were just waiting for the next treatment to be approved by the FDA before we could have any hope that we were going to make it. And so, so fortunately, there's been many, many, many treatment modalities approved over the years, and my health is good. It's controlled. My HIV is undetectable in my system, and I'm fortunate to be able to say that. The study itself was a gene therapy study where they took my identical twins' cells and infused them with something that would make them uninfectable. And then, because we had the same genetic makeup, they would infuse my brother's, they would grow my brother's cells and then infuse those cells in me. And the idea was that I would produce these uninfectable cells without it disrupting the genetic code, because we shared the same genetic code. This study was just a small part of a much larger study that looked at other illnesses as well. So there were similar studies for cancers and similar studies for blood diseases. And so the idea was that ultimately the NIH would create this super cell that was uninfectable for lots of diseases. And then those cells would be reproduced and given to people to keep them healthy and strong for, and make, help them live longer. In our subset, which of the HIV study, my brother and I, there's actually a section in the book where I write about this, but of course, most studies have to have a placebo group, right? And so we were unfortunate or fortunate enough to be part of the placebo group. It's odd that they actually tell you if you're getting modified genes or not. And I remember they notified us, my brother and me, and they told us that we would be part of the control group. So we would not be getting modified genes. So what I was getting was just a bunch of his genes, that his cells that were not modified. And that helped them. And it's interesting because even today, they could pull my blood and they could check to see which cells came from me and which cells were originally from my brother, because they did add a vector, but they didn't modify those genes. And so it didn't help with treatment of HIV. But also I would say that other people in the study who did get modified genes, it didn't seem to help them either. But it did answer other questions for the researchers, but it wasn't a treatment for HIV in the long
term. Very interesting. It's so fascinating. And so that's, you know, some of the medical part of this, but let's get now to some of the spookier stuff. I've always thought was very spooky. I think I told you that when we spoke earlier. I always thought that. And partly, I think it was because they did have their own language and a kind of telepathy between them. And towards the end of that section that you just read, these two boys come together and they literally do not want to be apart, and they pull their cribs together in the middle of the room. Mm-hmm. And they're only 6 months old. Now, I'm sure you don't remember that, but do you still have that kind of synergy between you and your brother?
You know, a lot of people think that, you know, we get questions like, if I hit you, does your brother feel it? And, you know, that those are kind of silly questions, but I will say that there are moments in our lives where we just feel like we have to reach out to the other. And maybe I haven't heard from my brother. I might reach out to him. I think he might be needing to hear from me. And lo and behold, I do. And he does, and vice versa. So there are those moments, but I think those moments might exist with other siblings as well. But then there are really spooky ones. There are very, very spooky ones where I remember when we were, for example, we were growing up, I took my bike out for a ride and I came to an intersection and I hit a car because it cut in front of me. I hit a car and I flipped over the car and I landed on my neck and I had whiplash and I had to wear a neck brace for 2 weeks or so, week or two. And after that happened, it was 1 week because exactly 1 week later, at the exact same intersection, the exact same thing happened to my brother. In fact, I ended up giving him my neck brace because it was like the hammy. So there are moments where weird things like that happen that we just can't really explain. And there are several stories like that throughout the book where where we just have to say that was a little bit too coincidental to be justified.
And the language that we were talking about is cryptophagia. Mm-hmm. Is there between you a remnant of that in any way when you are, let's say, talking at a cocktail party and you're both bored out of your minds? I mean, is there a language?
I think it would be more we often complete each other's thoughts. We often know what each other's thoughts are. There are times when we would not say anything in conversation. And then later I would say, so what did you think about that? And he'd say the exact same thing that I thought about that. And so there are those moments. There are things that we interpret in our way that I don't like a lot of times people might say, well, you know, I have that relationship with my brother and we're not twins, or my sister and we're not twins. But I think it's important to keep in mind that my brother and I also have two sisters. One of them passed away a month ago, which is sad, but we grew up with two sisters. Yes. And we all had the same upbringing. And so I don't have that. I'm close to my sisters, but I don't have that same kind of relation, that same kind of closeness that I do with my brother. And I think it's because my brother and I, we just sort of, we're on the same path. We're mentally and emotionally and spiritually. I think we're just sort of in sync, but we weren't always like that. That's the key. That's the other thing. There were times because of my homosexuality, particularly, he didn't talk to me. We didn't talk for 2 years. There was that time. And what we came to realize during those 2 years, he was very much involved in his church and I was very much involved in my homosexuality. And what we came to realize when I moved to Minnesota, I asked him to drive with me to Minnesota and he did. And it was one of the most meaningful experiences in my life because we talked a lot. You talk a lot when you're driving for 2 days. And we realized that growing up, we were always compared to each other. He was always the more social one. I was the one that had the better grades. So my family would compare him to me and our friends would compare me to him. And what we learned in that trip was there was a time when that stopped happening when we got to be adults, but we never stopped comparing ourselves to each other. And it wasn't until we realized that we could let go of that a little bit. And we could say, wow, this is the time where we get to explore who we are individually. And that was really meaningful because we hadn't really gotten to that point until I moved to Minnesota.
Mm. Well, the book just, it delves into all these wonderful things. And, you know, you ask questions about sameness and duality and lightness and darkness and, you know, the opposites, the identical opposites even within identical twins, evil twins, all of these different elements here are all things that you expand upon that people often don't think about. I've got a couple of nephews who are wonderful twins, Kieran and Louis in London, and they're just wonderful, and they do everything together. And I'm kind of not looking forward to the day when they have to be apart and grow a little bit and the rest of that. So, this book has really opened my mind about some things and reminded me of things that I already knew. So I really congratulate you on writing this and lovely book. And I wish you great luck with this in the future. And unfortunately, we've got to move on to the next part of the show. But I loved having you on the show again and come back with your next book.
Thank you, Ian. I really appreciate it.
All right. You've been listening to Self-Divided by John Medeiros. And now this.
Hello, Bill. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Welcome to Right on Radio. We're going to be talking with Bill Schnee, author of Chairman at the Board. It's going to be a fun interview, I think. Can you start with that little reading I talked to you about?
Yes. Just one second.
Sure.
Okay. Do you go live with this?
Yes.
When will that be?
We're live right now.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Wee-wee.
Okay. So here I'm picking it up in my book, which, you know, is my memoirs of my incredible career that I've been blessed to have. And I didn't know what to pick, but I just grabbed one here that a lot of people like the Beatles. So we only worked during the evenings, and every night different luminaries came down to hang out. The list included Brian Wilson, Mark Bolan, Billy Preston, and Peter Sellers, among others. I had never seen such a party while making an album. It was a very convivial atmosphere with so many people in the control room, the talking could get quite loud. I like to work with the speakers at a nominal level, not too loud and not too soft. I had already learned that when people start talking in the control room, you can't just turn the speakers up because they'll just talk louder. Turn up the speakers to get over the loud talk, and they'll talk even louder to get over the louder music. When that starts to happen, I usually turn the speakers off for a second and just ask everyone to please keep it down. However, with this crowd of notables in the control room on these sessions, I just pushed through as best I could. When Brian Wilson walked into the control room in the midst of all the goings on, it was a major thrill for me. But that incredible thrill turned to chill when later in the evening, I went to the bathroom and found Brian and Herny Nielsen crossing swords and acting like silly little boys. The amount of talent in those two bodies was immense, and it hurt to see them in their current condition. Still, Brian was one of my idols, and having two Beatles and the leader of the Beach Boys at my session, well, it doesn't get any better than that. Little did I know what was in store. Richard informed me that weekend that John Lennon had a song for Ringo and was coming in on Monday to record it. You mean with George and Ringo? I asked. Yes, that's exactly what it was to be, a Partials Beatle reunion. This would be the first the three of them had played together since their demise. John had written the song, I'm the Greatest, about himself right after the Beatles' breakup as a tongue-in-cheek therapy. So when Ringo asked John to write a song for the album, he reworked the lyrics to fit Ringo's storytelling singing style, which suited him perfectly. That Monday night, I had a new level of nervousness waiting for Lennon to show up at the studio. He had a deserved reputation for being very sharp with people. When he did arrive, it was in a flurry. As we were introduced, I heard that very identifiable voice we all know so well. There was a bit of tension mixed with frivolity as everyone met and talked to John. Ringo and George seemed very happy to see him, and he them. It seemed hard for him to sit still. He continually flitted about with his eyes constantly darting around. When they got down to business, there was no doubt who was in charge. Ringo, who up to that point had been the life of the party, was now quiet and intently looking to John for direction. George had been the leader on Photograph and very forward with ideas on the other songs he played on. Now he too looked to John for what to do next. It was decided that Ringo should play drums alone on this song. John was on piano and sang a guide vocal so Ringo could learn the song later. John pushed the session along at a good clip. He was quite dry-witted, which occasionally came out in certain comments as well as in his jokes. There was an air of creative intensity to the vibe as they worked the song out. Everyone in the studio that night was a pro and very much in their element. When a small bump in the road came up figuring out the middle eight of the song, the three Beatles worked it out with instant telepathy they still shared. Songcraft was an art they understood deeply. It was amazing to watch and offered a glimpse of what it must have been like when they were making their historic records. I couldn't believe that it was all happening right before my eyes. The whole experience was a pinch-me moment for sure. You could tell that when John was happy with the track, we would be done, and not before. But it didn't take very long at all. In fact, the whole session went by way too quickly for me. After that night with John, rumors started flying about a Beatles reunion, and predictably, The next night, there were TV crews at the entrance to Sunset Sound, hoping for a peek of the Fab Four to see if it was true.
All right, that was Bill Schnee from Chairman at the Board, talking, reading about a mini Beatles reunion without Paul. So welcome to Right on Radio, Bill. We are excited to have you. Why don't you talk about some of your life prior to becoming an engineer, just to get us a picture of what that was like.
You mean how I came into this wild business?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm an only child, and the kind some only children seem to be happy growing up that way. I wasn't. So the radio at an early age became my sibling. And in those days, radio was very different in that the disc jockeys held all the power and they would decide what they wanted to play. And even though a certain disc jockey would have a certain bend, certain kind of music he liked, if he heard something that was totally unrelated, he'd play that. So the point is, we got a very wide variety of music. I started music lessons in grade school, first the trumpet, then the sax, and ultimately, as a young teenager, started with piano lessons. When my parents moved to Los Angeles from Phoenix, on my senior year of high school, I met some guys that were starting a band, and I asked if they thought an organ would fit in, and they said, let's try it. So I had an organ, and we started a band together and writing songs. And we eventually saved our pennies and went to a recording studio to do some demos. And one of the guy's parents knew someone who knew someone in the music business. And that someone was a guy named Gary Usher. Gary was good friends with the Beach Boy Wilson family. In fact, he wanted to be a Beach Boy, but didn't get that job. But he did write In My Room and 409 with Brian. And Gary brought us into Capitol Records, where his office at the time was. And that was very exciting for me because I was slash am a huge Beach Boys fan. And I asked him when he took us to the studios, is this where Brian records? And he said, no, he records across town at a place called Western Recorders. But Gary signed us. He had just gotten a deal at Decca Records. And so he signed us to Decca Records. And in those days, you did four songs, and if you had a hit, they released a couple of singles. If you had a hit, you ran in and recorded six more, and suffice it to say, we never made an album. But on those early sessions, Gary brought in a session guitarist who turns out to also be an incredible engineer and producer named Richie Podler. And after we were dropped from Decca, I went to see Richie at his studio, and he said he could get us another record deal, which he did. And we went into his studio, which was a lot funkier than the ones we worked at, Capitol and Western, for the Decca contract. And yet, on the first playback of a track we had just cut, the sound that came out of the speakers brought such an emotional additive to our band, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. In fact, when the song ended, I turned to him and pointed at all the equipment and said, can you teach me how to do this? That was a real aha moment for me. And he said, no, I'm teaching Cooper. Get out there and do another take. But that's how it got started, for sure. It was that aha moment at Richie Podler's studio.
And did you get a break, or was it a slow, steady rise in terms of your engineering work?
Well, if I cut the story down a bit, it turns out that I got a job in a local recording studio that was not very professional, but it was a start. And when the owner decided we needed a new console recording board, he brought in a guy that he'd heard great things about named Toby Foster. And Toby listened to what I had been recording there in the studio. And he said, you know, you've really got a knack for this. And I thought he was just being nice, but I saw over time that he was serious. And he ended up being a great mentor to me, because he got a job in LA as a tech and mastering engineer. And I went back to school. I dropped out of college for 2.5 years chasing the band. And by now I'm back in school. But I went every day after school to the studio he worked at, and you would just ask as many questions as he'd let me ask. And because all of my aptitude in school was in math, it was in math and science, where that intersected with, where that on the left brain intersected with my musical right brain, just made learning engineering incredibly easy. So easy, in fact, that 2.5 years after that aha moment with Richie, where I didn't know the difference between a limiter and an equalizer, 2.5 years later, I begged my way into a job back in that same studio with Richie. And he threw me in. He threw me in on a Three Dog Night session, and I don't know what he was thinking, because he wasn't producing them then. He was just engineering them, and their producer also produced Steppenwolf. So he that Richie engineered. So it was his biggest client with his two biggest acts, and why he did that, I'll never know. But he did it, and I managed to swim. And so from there, it grew kind of very, very quickly for me. So that was like in 1969. And I just recounted when I went to work for Richie. And I just read the story of the Beatles, which was 4 years later.
What was, okay, so the first band you engineered for was Three Dog Night, or you engineered for some lesser bands prior to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, nobody that anyone would ever have heard of, though, in that early studio, believe me. Like I said, it was quite a bit less than professional, actually kind of comical in retrospect. He had egg cartons on the wall for sound absorption. The console, quote unquote, was nothing more than a little 8-channel mixer with no tone controls and just like guitar reverb for echo. He only had 2 professional condenser mics. You get the picture. And but the good part about it was that it was only 2-track, which meant that every session that was done there was done completely live. So I was able to learn mixing from day one. The idea that because, you know, they are out there performing and you're making the final mix, that would prove to be very helpful in my career all the way through till today.
Actually, I'm a musician myself, so the egg carton thing is very familiar to me. Sit up and against the wall, you know. Yeah. You say in the book that you love popular music, and I'm wondering, you know, where your love of that came from. I assume when you were a kid, there was a bit of rock and roll stuff going on in there, too, in your mind. So, but how do you define popular music, and what is your love of it about?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I love all kinds of music. Now, the record business, you know, the record business loves to put you in a box. Mm-hmm. You know, you belong in this box, so you can't play with these toys in this box. And the case in point, which is kind of funny. So I came out of American Recording, which became the hottest rock studio in Los Angeles in 1970, and went on as such. I had worked when I left Richie. Pretty soon, I went to work for CBS, and I worked with a producer named Richard Perry on an album that he was doing with Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. And so that was fine and good, and a lot of interesting, needless to say, stories about that, having somebody with that kind of talent in front of me doing a one-on-one concert, basically. But he went on, Richard Perry went on to do England, to do an album with Carly Simon. It's the No Secrets album with You're So Vain on it. And he recorded and called me and said that he was just about finished mixing the album, but there were 2 rock songs that he was saving for me on the album. And that just shows, you know, the perception, his perception, because of where I came from. And, it, 10 years later, I could beg to get a rock album, and the record business would never let me out of the box, you know, put me back in that box again. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot. I've loved all kinds of music, but yeah, I am a singles junkie for sure. Pop music kind of junkie. Funny enough, R&B is my favorite genre, I think, if I have to pick one. And I was very fortunate to do quite a few things in that genre, not as many as I might have liked, but I'm not complaining.
Well, you worked with Marvin Gaye, correct?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
Marvin.
What a, Jackson's, what a, I think you have listed, and I've read about, and also, of course, Whitney Houston. Talk about Whitney Houston. What was that like?
You know, I always want to give simple answers that is not what you're looking for, which is incredible. Can we go on?
Yes.
But seriously, there's a great R&B artist named Teddy Pendergrass.
Oh, sure.
Was,
I know of him.
And he had the unfortunate accident that cost him his ambulatory. He became a quadriplegic. And I mixed the first album he did after his accident, which was not the Teddy of old, because obviously sitting in a wheelchair, you can't, haven't got the same kind of power that you do being able to stand up and have the diaphragm work the way it wants to for that. But in the course of mixing that album, the producer said that there's, by the way, there's a duet on this album, Bill. So this afternoon, while you start the next song, I'm going to go record the duet partner. I said, okay. So he left and I went on to the next song, and he came back several hours later. And I said, how did it go? And he had this look on his face and he just said, unbelievable. This girl is drop dead gorgeous and sings like a bird. And I said, what's her name? He said, you haven't heard of her. Her name's Whitney Houston. And she had been signed by Clive Davis already. Clive signed her so that no one else would. But he, to his credit, and he's done it before and he's done it since, he worked very diligently to prepare a major star. So anyway, that song was on Teddy's album. And then a year and a half or so later, when she did her first album, I mixed several songs on that album, including two of the hit singles. The duet was on her first album as well. But, you know, I suppose my greatest experience with Whitney was with the movie The Bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her first motion picture to act in. And all of the songs in the movie were actually records made in a studio that in the film she just lip syncs. But the producer, David Foster, called me and said, for the closing number on the movie, it's a ballad and the camera's going to be right in her face and she doesn't want to have to, it's a very explosive song and she doesn't think that lip syncing is going to make it. So she wants to record it live when they shoot the film. So will you please get a recording truck? They're shooting this scene at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami and meet me in Miami with a recording truck on such and such a date. So that's what I did. And the band, I knew the band members very well. And I got there and did the setup and ran through the song and whatnot, waiting for David and Whitney to come down. And finally, she got there. And the most amazing thing about that is that here at that point, by that point in time, Whitney had sung in front of 20,000 seaters all the time, a couple of big 100,000 seat festival things. And yet in this small ballroom, in the Fontainebleau Hotel with a crew of maybe 30 people, when we started filming, she was very obviously nervous. And so take one, and then we said, well, good, let's do another one. You know, take two, and still kind of nervous. And they took a mini break and just let her shake it off and came back for take three, which was definitely better. But not what you'd want. And so they took a big break. And when that ended, came back, the next take was really good. I mean, it was a far cry from what they did. But on take five, let me tell you, when she went to that, this is obviously the song, and I Will Always Love You. When she went to that last and I, every hair on the back of my neck, and I imagine a lot of other necks there, went flaring up. It was just a moment to behold. And then, like any good director, when it was over, he went, "Oh my gosh, Whitney, that was sensational. Let's just do one more for protection."
Oh boy.
You gotta love the movie business.
Yes. Now it's funny because I have always heard that Whitney was kind of a diva, but in your book it sounds like she's just humble and wonderful person, and or she was, and so it sounds like you had a very good experience rather than a diva-like experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I think is even more astounding is that with Barbara Streisand, who I've worked with many times over the years, and as far as I know, I'm the only person I've ever met that doesn't have something bad to say about working with her. Hmm. But I've never had the first problem. I mean, the closest thing to a problem was on an orchestra date where she was singing live, where she wasn't happy with her headphone mix. Until she got happy, she wasn't going to sing. But you know, that can happen a lot, but it wasn't any, you know, it was worked out in, you know, 3-4 minutes. But she's, you know, I say in the book, you know, I've never been afraid to tell an artist if they want something that's going to get them in trouble or cause a problem, to tell them, you know, you shouldn't do that. And, you know, I don't remember the first time I did that. I know I must have done that with Barbara, and I'm sure she would say, "What do you mean?" Because she's very demanding, but incredibly intelligent, and has a memory, just an astounding memory. She can tell you the way she sang a song, you know, 2 weeks ago. She can tell you the notes that she sang. But I do that because if it's going to get them up a tree, and we're going to end up on a branch that's liable to break off and both come tumbling down, if I explain that to an artist, you know, they'll respect that. And so I don't know if a lot of people have gotten intimidated by her or what, or if I've just been darn lucky, to tell you the truth. But
well, clearly, yeah, you have the engineering chops too to gain respect from these folks. And that was another question I wanted to ask you. Was early in your career, and even maybe later, did you ever feel intimidated or afraid of these quite famous people?
I can't say honest. I mean, you know, when they threw me in with Three Dog Night, I mean, it was more just plain fear, because here I was, the first time I'd ever been with a major artist, you know, and I hadn't been engineering that long. And then, like I said, it was about 2 years after that I'm recording Barbara Streisand. I can't say that I've ever been intimidated that way, to be honest. I mean, I've been very nervous about sessions, how they were going to go and that kind of thing. But no, not really.
I'm curious now, everything's going digital. And my experiences in recording my own music have been all analog. And I also used to do some light work, and that was not computerized, but with faders and whatnot. How do you feel like things are changing? Is it change for the better, or is it kind of the same, or is it change for the worse, which with recording everything digitally?
Well, whether good or bad, it definitely has changed in a major way. And the easy way to describe it for me is that when digital first came out, I absolutely hated it. Why? Because I didn't think it sounded good. I thought we had been sold a bill of goods, because there was no noise for sure. The noise was gone, but there was a coldness to the sound, an absolute coldness. And the high end was kind of hashy. And since then, of course, we've obviously learned a tremendous amount. You know, it's interesting with analog, from the late 40s when the Germans developed it until now, it really hadn't changed that much at all. The emulsions on the recording tape changed, not in some ways better, in some ways not, but the actual mechanics of it never really changed. Meanwhile, with regard to digital, everything has changed. We do higher sampling frequencies. We have better filtering now. We have better converters. And without getting too crazy technical, the sound of CDs, which is basically, if you just look at it, 16-bit 44-1, 41,000. That which never did sound that good to me, now we can record 24-bit at 192K. So it's divided up into more pieces, and it's sampled, you know, many, many more times a second. And what that allows for is a lot of what was missing in early digital. So I've you know, made a major turnaround as far as it goes. The when the hard disk system called Pro Tools came out, I had a second engineer in my recording studio that was a computer whiz, and I bought it for him, basically. And as he was showing me everything that it did, and there's no question that the production value of a hard disk, you know, computer recording is astounding compared to analog tape, which just captures the sound because you can manipulate it in, you know, six ways to Sunday. But so what has happened is for me a complete turnaround from those early days to now, where I think the best capture we possibly have is 24/192 with really good converters. Unfortunately, not that many people are using it to record. Hmm. Especially unfortunate since it's since storage is so cheap. But we still have the bigger problem to me with it is that now that the world has gone digital, the playback is digital and it's not at a super high sampling rate, and especially now streaming. And there are some, you know, a couple of streaming companies that are doing it better than, you know, better than the average. But, I still long for the day when people will have, you know, speakers in a room and sit and listen like we do when we make the records. You know, unfortunate thing that Steve Jobs did, he didn't invent MP3s and all, but he just made he kept people sort of from stealing it by coming up with the process that he did with, you know, iTunes and so on. And but what that kind of situation has brought about is that music, in great part, has become something you do while you're doing something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose the first Walkman is what started that, the cassette player that you could put in your pocket and listen to the album, where music became portable. But whatever the cause, and I think it's great that you can, you know, listen to music while you're at the gym or, you know, whatever, doing your homework. I guess kids always did that. But I still think there's so much value to sitting between some, you know, reasonable speakers and listening to something with a degree of resolution.
This radio station still has turntables, so we're unique in that regard. Say, we're running out of time. Why don't you let me know what your next project is? Or are you retired, or are you still doing projects?
Oh, no, I'm still going. I've got two albums that one is just about finished. Two of the best albums I've engineered in the last 10 years. Mm. One of them is by a girl I produced 25 years ago, the only country record I ever produced, a girl named Mandy Barnett, who in the book I say is one of the best singers I ever put a microphone in front of. Mm-hmm. And as you know, with the fortunate career I've had, that's saying something. And her album that's coming out in May is the songs from the last Billie Holiday album, Torch Songs, they were, and all orchestrated by a great, one of the great old-time arrangers, Sammy Nestico. It's a kind of a cute story. The producer called him up and said, we're going to do these Torch Songs, and I have an incredible singer. I'd like you to do the arrangements. And Sammy said, I'm 95 years old. You know, why don't you let me do one, and you give it to somebody to model the rest after. So producer said, okay, fine. So he did the first one and sent it in. And And the producer called him and said, boy, it's beautiful. And Sammy said, why don't you let me do another? And you know where that's going.
Yeah.
So yes, at 95 years old, he did all 10 songs. And I recorded it live with a 60-piece orchestra and this amazing singer at Ocean Way Studios here in Nashville.
You know, and, Bill, I'm going to have to cut you off, I'm afraid, because we're running out of time. But I have certainly enjoyed this interview. We could talk for hours.
Okay, great.
So thank you very much for being on Right on Radio with us. We've been talking with Bill Schnee, author of Chairman at the Board, recording the soundtrack of a generation. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.